The Aging Long-Term Care Committee will come to order. We are just short of quorum at the moment, but do want to start on time and get things moving. We will have Representative Backer with House File 3169. If you could please come forward. All right, and when we are able to, I will move House File 3169 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. But until that time, Representative Backer, if you'd like to start presenting your bill.
Yes, I would. Thank you. And I promise it won't be as active as yesterday in this room, okay? Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, HF 3169 provides a rate for nonprofit nursing homes located in Moorhead equal to the medium rate for nursing homes located next to North Dakota cities, right next to Moorhead. This bill continues the work that Representative Lean and I started last year when we were able to enact a similar provision for a nursing home in Breckenridge, Minnesota. Although seeing a more realistic state budget now, North Dakota in recent years has raised its Medicaid rates paid to nursing homes. This has led to a wide rate of disparity in rates paid in border communities like Breckenridge and Moorhead, and has resulted in several staffing issues for nursing homes located in Minnesota communities. The nursing homes reform bill last year does help address this disparity, but it did not completely solve the problem in Moorhead. I have with me today Mark Bertelrude. Thank you, sir. Thank you. From Evertide Lutheran Home in Moorhead, Minnesota. And I will turn it over to him. And I also have Representative Ben Lean here. Thank you.
All right. Welcome, Representative Lean and Mr. Bertelrude. Please introduce yourself for the committee and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Bertelrude, and I'm the Executive Director and Administrator for Eventide Senior Living Communities in Moorhead, and I want to thank Representatives Backer and Lean for bringing this legislation forward. Eventide is experiencing the significant challenge of the rate differential between ourselves and the North Dakota nursing homes within the Fargo-Moorhead metropolitan area. In a comparison of our 2016 rates, six of the North Dakota facilities had their 1.0 case mix rate about 22% higher on average than the rate that we are currently reimbursed, and that does exclude our property. Our rate is about $202 per resident per day, and those North Dakota facilities range from $236 to $272 per resident per day for an average of $247. And simply put, in a competitive marketplace, that differential just really is not sustainable. As I joined Eventide a few years back, we had planned on an expansion. That expansion had been approved. Our goal was to adapt our building to meet the needs of our current residents and staff and to get closer to market expectations that both our industry and our North Dakota competitors were setting. And we had no choice but to halt that project. We had a couple of issues. We could not staff the beds, and primarily we were concerned with the operational challenges of trying to compete in a reimbursement environment that left us thinking more about contraction than it did about expansion or updating. And that need is still there, but our Minnesota need is often being met by North Dakota facilities. The 2015 nursing home reform legislation has without question helped us, and we are very grateful and appreciative of that. However, looking forward, we still see substantial challenge, and we want to assure a level playing field for reimbursement for years to come. We want to avoid the issue going forward in a community and a metropolitan area that encompasses two state reimbursement models. So, again, thank you very much for the opportunity, and I encourage you to support HF 3169.
Thank you, Mr. Bertelrude. And we do have quorum now, so I'm going to call the committee officially to order and officially move that House File 3169 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Representative Lean, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you have any testimony to give on this bill, we'd be glad to take it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to thank Representative Backer for carrying the reform bill, or the Breckenridge, Border City, I should say, reform bill last session, and continuing his efforts this session to kind of clean up some things we weren't able to do last session. And I just wanted to speak a little bit about some of the specific challenges. Mr. Bertelrud kind of hinted at that already. But we do have reciprocity agreements with North Dakota. Minnesota does. And so basically, when a Minnesota medical assistance resident is served by a North Dakota facility, Minnesota has to pay the higher rate. Conversely, when a North Dakota resident is served by a Minnesota facility, i.e. Eventide or St. Francis, the two nonprofits that would be, this bill would be of particular interest to, they are charged that lower Minnesota rate. So we have, you know, a little bit of an imbalance there, and that's, basically what we're trying to do here, what we wanted to do last year also. And so, again, I thank Representative Backer for carrying this legislation, and thank Mr. Bertelrud for making a trip down to St. Paul.
Mr. Chair, those are my testifiers, so we'll entertain any questions.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? Seeing no one. Questions from members? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Backer. I appreciate what you're doing. But do you know how many other cities or towns are facing the same kind of issue?
Representative Backer.
I do not have an exact number, Representative. I do know that with the situation that Breckenridge and Moorhead has, you know, I know on the western part of the state the challenges that we have. So Iowa and Wisconsin, I do not have that figure.
Representative Rosenthal. Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can anybody explain this thing about why we pay the higher North Dakota rate for our residents and why North Dakota pays the lower rate? And I assume there's some kind of formal reciprocity agreement there. And, you know, how etched in stone is that? And how long's that been going on? And just a little more about, who pays it? Does that, I assume that's paid by out of the Medicaid funds and not by any nursing home in the border region, right? Oh, the big guns now.
Yeah. Chair, if I could let Kevin Gruen answer that question, go ahead.
Yes, welcome to the committee. If you please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Liebling, and I represent Eventide Lutheran Home on this issue. To answer your question, there is a reciprocity agreement between North Dakota and Minnesota which pays, where they agree for a certain period of time while the resident is in a facility in the other state to pay that state's rate. So the way it's set up right now, North Dakota, all their facilities have higher rates than what that you would see in the Minnesota side. And so when a North Dakota resident comes to Minnesota, they get to pay the Minnesota rate. And when a Minnesota resident goes to North Dakota, they pay the North Dakota rate. And Medicaid pays for that if they're eligible for Medicaid. If it's private pay, the private pay gets to pay for that. So what you may see happening, and I think this is pretty true, is that North Dakota person who's private pay would prefer to come to Eventide, high quality of service, lowest rates in town. But when you get into Medicaid, then that also holds true for that as well. So that's one issue. The other issue in the Fargo-Moorhead market is there really is almost no access to nursing home beds there. It's really hard to get into a nursing home bed in that entire market. And the only beds that are really available, so it's a very difficult market to even find a placement and where you can be served in a nursing home. So it's not where there's a bunch of open beds in the North Dakota side or the Minnesota side. It's really a constricted market, and it's really challenging.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. This stuff is so complicated. I mean, I'm sure we all feel that way, except maybe the chair.
I just fake it till I make it.
But so the main reason then that we're talking about the disparity in funding on the sides of the border is because the impact on hiring employees. Is that why that even plays into this? Because otherwise I don't really see how the funding, why we would adjust funding for
that is
purpose.
Certainly Representative Mr. Chair,
Myrtle Root.
Representative, the The issue of wages is certainly a significant piece. In looking back, I've been with Eventide for about 3 years now, and the rate that we pay our caregivers, let's take our certified nurse assistants, which is the majority of our care staff, in the last 4 years, the rates that we pay that group has increased 44%. And I am happy to be able to do that. They're a hardworking group of people who give their lives to doing some very important work. But that market continues to shift on. It used to be that we would look at annual increases now to remain competitive in the market, not only with our Fargo long-term care competitors, but just with the economy and every retail and fast food location that labor market is driving out of control. And that rate, 44% for our certified nurse assistants, 33% increases for our registered nurses, as we're also competing mightily with our large hospital systems in town.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I don't know that the relevant issue, though, is that one, because we dealt with that issue with the big reform. I mean, that's kind of the same issue for everybody, I guess is what I'm saying, whether, you know, what it is, you know, whether people who do other jobs are going to prefer those other jobs to working in nursing homes. That's a different issue. I mean, we've got, it's the cross-border issue I'm kind of going after here, right? Because that's the justification for why you need the bill, because there's a differential across the border, not because it's in town with the people who are doing other kinds of jobs. So I guess I'd like to know how, how the wages on the Minnesota side compare to the wages for the same work on the Dakota side.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Myrtle-Rood.
We have attempted to keep those very similar in rates, because we understand that for us, if we are paying significantly less than our friends across the river, we simply are not going to maintain a workforce. And so given the discrepancy in the reimbursement rates, our Fargo competition most often leads that market, and they will make those rate increases ahead of what we are able to do, and then we're in a position of having to keep up. And if we are unable to keep up for any lengthy period of time, we simply lose the ability to attract new workers at all, and even get to the point where current workers are considering simply going across the river for a significant pay increase. And so I think the issue is perhaps the same in any community. The fact that we are literally just across the river from a different state reimbursement system, and a reimbursement system that's been much healthier than ours has been over time, the significance of that challenge is much greater, I believe, in Moorhead or in a border community with North Dakota.
Mr. Goodenow, did you have?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, another issue just to keep in mind, and this is part of the complexity of the system. We have the equalization requirement that you can't charge private pay more than the Medicaid rate in Minnesota. That's part of, keep that in mind. The real public policy issue around this is, do you want to maintain Medicaid beds in Moorhead? Because the development is taking place on the Fargo side. And if Eventide were to get out of the Medicaid market, they could fill those beds with private pay patients and could charge them what they wanted. And so that's the issue, is it's really the public policy need to maintain those Medicaid beds on the Moorhead side of the river and be able to serve the people, the Minnesota residents in that community.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will be the last one from me for a little while. But so could somebody explain, since we did this big reform, why this issue is still there? Because I thought we took care of all the problems. Apparently Moorhead got excluded last year or something. But could you just explain, you know, why we're back with the same kinds of issues that we've always had, even though we've done this big cost-based reform?
Mr. Goodenow.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, we addressed Moorhead's an outlier. And Eventide's an outlier still. We were able to deal with the Breckenridge issue last year, and a part of it, I think, had to do with the end of session discussions with the Senate and everything else. But it's clearly an outlier, and the system itself that was passed, the reforms that were passed last year, but for the Breckenridge area, did not dealt with the internal, within the state, competitive issues. This is the unique situation along the North Dakota border. And to answer your previous question about other communities that are impacted by this. These are the only two Minnesota board, I'm sorry, Representative Rosenthal, the only two communities that have nonprofit nursing homes along the North Dakota border. So it addresses all of those, and we're not seeing the same situation along the other borders. But that's the reason. It was just an anomaly, it's an outlier. We're trying to finish that work with this legislation this session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions for the testifiers? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for Mr. Goodnow. We talked a lot about last year our one-payer system here and that there's not a lot of states that do this. I think one or two, I think, in the nation. Can you give me an idea, what is the difference right now in Fargo, North Dakota, from private pay to their Medicaid payer? Just an approximate percentage. I'm just kind of curious what that might be because I'm not sure we really talked about that much last year. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Baker, there are two states in the country that have equalization, Minnesota and North Dakota. So when Mr. Brittlerud mentioned the difference in the change, the disparity, they pay the same amount in North Dakota as the private pay, but their rates are higher because their Medicaid rates have been reimbursed at a much higher level.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any further questions for the testifiers? Seeing none. Any final comments, Representative Backer, Representative Lean?
Thank you. No, Mr. Chair, members, other than thank you for your time and attention on this issue again.
Yes, ditto.
Okay, thank you. With that, then, I will renew my motion that House File 3169 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion prevails, and House File 3169 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Thank you very much. Representative Zerwas, if you could make your way down for House File 3048. While Representative Zerwas is making his way down, Representative Anderson moves the approval of the minutes from March 16th. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to those minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Representative Zerwas, welcome to the committee. I move that House File 3048 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. We have the bill before us, and I understand that there's a delete all amendment, Representative Zerwas, the DE1. I will move the DE1, Representative Zerwas, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, the DE1 addresses some concerns from initial meeting with stakeholders. And it puts the bill in the shape in which I'd like to discuss it. It's the only amendment on the bill.
Okay, is there any discussion to the amendment to get the bill into the form that the author wishes to have it? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a challenging bill to talk about and move forward. This bill deals with hospice, respite, and palliative care for children with life-threatening illnesses and terminal or chronic illnesses. This bill came out of a discussion I had over the interim with a group who's trying to move forward and build a respite or hospice home to provide palliative care for families dealing with a child or children that have severe chronic health conditions, and certainly a bill that hit home with me, and to understand just the complex issues and the challenges that these families face when dealing with a child that may be born and initially have a very short period but undetermined period to be with us and their family, or now that has very significant, serious chronic medical conditions that require perhaps a in-home nursing staff, nursing assistant, ventilator, or other medical equipment that after months and months and months and years and years and years, if you have brothers or sisters of that sick child, what ends up happening is the entire family members revolves around the care of their sick son or daughter or brother or sister to the point where if you have a child that's lived for a year or two at an end-of-life scenario where they may be on a ventilator or other very intense medical interventions, there is no day away. There is no long weekend. There is no vacation. That is not an option for these families without help. And the help that a home like Crescent Cove can provide is either take care of a sick or ill child for those final moments and help a child pass away that that the family would prefer doesn't pass away in the hospital, in an ICU room, with the beeps and the buzzers and the nurses popping in. But they also don't feel comfortable with the child passing away in their living room or in their bedroom of their home. And they want to find somewhere where they can provide peace and love and support for their baby, for their toddler, for their teenager. And so that's what this bill is about. That's what we're trying to do. I have with me Katie Lindenfelser, the founder of Crescent Cove, who can talk a little bit about the necessity of an environment like this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives, and thank you, Representative Zerwas, for bringing this bill. Crescent Cove is the name of our organization. It was founded as Children's Lighthouse of Minnesota in 2009 with a vision to build the first residential children's hospice and respite home here in Minnesota, serving children with a shortened life expectancy in their families. And it's our mission to offer care and support to children as well as young adults who have a shortened life expectancy and their families. There are only two homes like this in our country. One is in Phoenix, Arizona, and one is in San Francisco, outside of San Francisco, California. It's a model, however, that started over 30 years ago in the UK, where there are now over 50 homes like this for children. I spent a number of years working with children with life-threatening conditions at the University of Minnesota Children's Hospital and also at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, and then spent time in Melbourne, Australia, working at a children's hospice, and saw that those were many of the same families with children with similar diagnoses to those that I cared for at here in Minnesota, asking for another place to go for respite, for short break, or while their child was dying, if they didn't want to be at home or the hospital. Right now in our state, we have a number of adult residential hospices, but none to serve the unique needs of children and their families. The home we're looking to build will have 8 rooms for children and 3 family suites, so families can stay if they'd like as well, or they could take a break, as Representative Zerwas mentioned, for respite. We'll have living and dining spaces, rooms for creative arts, spiritual care, music therapy, and hydrotherapy. We're looking at a site now here in St. Paul. In addition to working to build this home, we're currently providing support services and covering the costs for services that are not covered by insurance, and services like massage and music therapy, creative arts and spiritual care, and counseling that will be provided once the home is built as well. And advocacy is another of our goals. We held our first pediatric palliative care symposium this past October, and that included a number of families, clinicians, and policymakers like Representative Zerwas, who we're grateful to have spoken, and also Natalie Wilson was here today to speak as well. We have a collaboration among all of the Twin Cities pediatric hospital leaders and clinicians who we met together with in February. This legislation adjustment is a first step as we look to find avenues for reimbursement for children who would stay at this home. There are thousands of families in Minnesota who are caring for a child with a shortened life expectancy with conditions such as cancer, muscular dystrophy, spinal muscular atrophy, heart and lung conditions, genetic, chromosomal, or neurological disorders requiring 24/7 around-the-clock care at their homes or at the hospital. We anticipate the home will be used 80% of the time for respite or for short breaks and 20% of the time for end-of-life care when a child is dying. We need these license changes in order to move forward to continue to look at reimbursement avenues, and we thank you for considering our bill.
Thank you, Ms. Lindenfelser, for your work on this and for your testimony this morning. Ms. Wilson, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Natalie Wilson. I have worked in the neonatal intensive care unit for the last 10 years, and I also am a Brave Mama. And I've worked with many of these children that could use a home like this, and these families that in the hospital you're provided health care and a little bit of emotional support, but having a child that is chronically ill, that is nearing end of life at any moment, rocks your whole world. And the hospital isn't always equipped to provide the total holistic care that Crescent Cove can. With our second son, I found myself on the other side of the looking glass. And halfway through our pregnancy, we learned he would have a shortened life. And we didn't know if he would live for 5 minutes or up to a year. And that left our family reeling and looking for support. And working in the Twin Cities for the last 10 years, I thought, there's got to be a lot out there. And I came to find there really wasn't. You are in the hospital for acute care, and then you go home. And it's up to you to care for the family. Crescent Cove can provide not only these ancillary support services, but also a place for a dignified death for children. People don't like to talk about death of children, but it happens, and it happens all the time. And we as families and we as healthcare practitioners don't have a place to send these families if they prefer not to die in the hospital and not to die at home.
All right, Ms. Wilson, thank you for sharing your story and mm-hmm. for all the work and care that you provide for people around your area.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3048 this morning? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate this bill, first of all. I'm wondering, is there a, do we similarly provide something already for respite care for children with significant disabilities that don't necessarily fit this shortened life expectancy definition?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, it's my understanding that there isn't anything in statute that allows for reimbursement for the respite care provision. That's one of the big delineators is allowing for reimbursement for the break of time. That's my understanding.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm not sure if it would fit with reimbursement, you know, requirements and whatnot, but I'd be interested in seeing you look into whether you could include, you know, broaden your definition of children that could qualify for this to families that need respite care for a child with severe disabilities. I know several families that might appreciate such a thing.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Yarusso. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not really sure who to direct the question, or I have so many questions, having sat on the board of Quiet Oaks Hospice House in St. Cloud. I know some of the challenges that you face, and quite frankly, we never talked about children there. And I don't know that they're excluded, but I know what you're aiming to do is to fit the facility to meet it. So, and maybe I would love to sit and chat with you sometime to see how you plan on doing it, because I know one of the challenges Quiet Oaks has is that they don't take Medicare because they wanted to keep it house-like, home-like. They didn't want to make it more institutionalized. And I think that's something we need to look at, because what families want is more of a home setting away from home. And if you accept Medicare, it's gotta look more like a nursing home, and that's what most hospice facilities don't want. And so I think you've got some wonderful, wonderful ways to make children feel at home and, you know, and not do Medicare. So I'm very concerned about how you're going to do it, because I know it's difficult, but yet so excited for you. And I think what you bring forward is the fact that, yeah, we don't talk about kids, and it happens all the time. And I don't know if Quiet Oaks ever had any, you know, I take that back. One of their first residents was a young man, and he maybe was in his 20s, but that was about it. So I really appreciate the fact that you're doing this. I didn't realize there wasn't anything in Minnesota, and I think it's time we start being a front runner in hospice care, because I think there's a lot of challenges with hospice care, and I have seen the benefits and the families and their appreciation of not having to be a 24-hour caregiver. they can be the child, they can be the family and not have to do the care. So thank you so much, and truly I would love to sit and chat with you someday and see what your challenges are and see what we can do to help you to get there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Ms. Wilson.
I just wanted to add a little something that working in a children's hospital, we have children's hospitals, we have pediatric units for a reason, because the needs of children are different than the needs of an adult, and the needs of a dying child or a chronically ill child are different than that of an adult. And quite honestly, being a nurse, we all have our comfort zones, and so adult nurses say, I would never do children, and children nurses say, I would never do adults. And so you bring up a valid point that many hospice homes that are in existence aren't always comfortable taking children on, and the families feel that, and the families want to feel comforted. They want to feel like they can trust the staff with their chronically ill child, and Crescent Cove can provide that place for us.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Zerwas, thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. I mean, it's pointing out a definite need in Minnesota. Way back when I was in college, I volunteered in Nottingham, England, in the second hospice in England for a year, and it was just an amazing experience. I'm so glad that the hospice model has, you know, come to our country, of course. And you're right, kids are often left off the table, and then so I think it's so important, that component plus the other part of offering a relief for the parents. So I really strongly support your bill, and I'm not sure that we're going to be limiting this to one. I mean, there's going to be, I mean, I can just see where there will be a clear need, you know, in multiple places throughout the state. And but thank you very much for bringing it forward, and I think it's really a great bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas, for this bill. I'd like to tag on to what was mentioned before about having respite care for young people who may not be terminally, have terminal issues, but I met with some families recently, and one woman in particular said, she finally arranged to she wanted to take a vacation, so she arranged with her care providers to watch her daughter for a week. But then when she came back, they all wanted a week off, so she was back where she started from. So we really do need to be looking into respite care for children as a whole that have the disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Zerwas.
And just for the definition, so lines 2.1 to 2.5 of the bill, of the TE one that we adopted, talk about the definition of respite care. It talks, when necessary to relieve the hospice patient's family or the family of a child with a condition suggesting a shortened life expectancy. So I think the language does allow for a little bit broader of a term. And if there's a way, Representative Russo, to work to expand that but not overwhelm, I think that's something that we're obviously very interested in, because as you've expressed, the need is present.
To follow up, Representative Mason.
Oh, no, thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also appreciate that you're here, and this is really important stuff. I have a couple of, just a basic question about the bill, and then I have some questions about what Representative Tice mentioned. So my first question about the bill is just, does the bill itself add this to the definition for purposes of licensing or funding, but from Medicaid or both?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. This amendment adjustment to the legislation is directly related to the residential hospice license, so licensing the facility.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. And then Representative Tice was talking about a facility taking Medicare. I'm not sure if she meant Medicaid or really Medicare. Could be either. But I guess it's more a question to staff because she made a comment that I kind of took me aback, which is that when they take Medicare that they can't have a home-like facility. And I just wondered if that's because most that take funding don't have a home-like facility, or is that actually something about the funding stream that prevents it from being a more home-like facility? I wonder if Ms. Pugnelli or anybody else can answer that.
Yes, if someone could please answer that. I'm sorry, I can't remember how to pronounce your last name.
Elizabeth Clarkvist.
Clarkvist. I'm writing it down this time.
Okay. Mr. Right. Chair and Representative Liebling, I don't know about the requirements for Medicare reimbursement since that's a federal issue, but I can look into that and get back to you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Is it all right if we take the
sure.
testifier? Okay. Ms. Lindenfelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. Children don't access a Medicare hospice benefit. Some residential adult hospices are Medicare certified, and in order for us long-term, you know, looking long-term at sustainability and reimbursement, because there isn't a reimbursement model that would sustain the home, and right now it's through philanthropic support, Medicaid relies on the Medicare certification in order to provide reimbursement. So that's a great concern that you brought up, Representative Tice, about the requirements for accessibility and life safety codes cause sometimes the home to look less than home-like and more institutional-like. And there are a handful of residential adult hospices in Minnesota that are certified, Medicare certified, that do. You know, it's subjective, I guess, as to whether or not they do look or feel like a home. But that's certainly the goal, to be home-like.
Thank you, Representative Weaver. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So so I take it then that it's more of a Medicare issue than a Medicaid. In other words, I guess for purposes of us, it's not something we have control over. Obviously, if it's Medicare, as Ms. Clarkvist mentioned, that's federal. So we don't have lots to impact. But it's the first time I've heard that funding stream would impact how home-like it could be, and it's just really kind of striking. But I take it you did mean Medicare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, exactly. What their vision was, and actually it was modeled after something here in the cities. It was a hospice home that the gentleman who started its brother was at. And it just felt like home. It looked like home. Where if Medicare gets involved, it has to look, you know, pretty much like a nursing home. And that's not what they wanted. I mean, the fact was that this was a place to come and spend your last days. So you aren't going to be, I mean, it was the accessibility issues, and most of these folks aren't walking around the hallways. And so they wanted it to look like they were at home. And to have that feeling and not feel like they were in a nursing home. And so in order to do that, they do not participate in Medicare.
Representative Liebling?
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Caruso?
I have nothing further. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is actually a really specific question because I have a constituent. Would a child with Rett's syndrome qualify for respite care under this?
Ms. Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. Yes.
Representative Considine.
Thank you. Could you tell me what the difference is then in, I hate to get down to this, but what it would cost per day for a child to do this versus home health nurses?
Ms. Lindenfelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. We're just refining our demand analysis and cost analysis at the home. But the homes in other parts, the two in our country, the daily rate for a child, it's between $700 and $1,000 a day, which is significantly less than a child staying in a hospital, and is slightly more depending on the number of hours that the child or family have home care in their homes. But however, most families don't have 24/7 home care, or maybe they do just one or two nights a week. So related to the cost.
Representative Considine.
Thank you. Well, again, the family that I'm thinking about does have 24/7, and thank you.
Okay, any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Zerwas, any final comments on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I think this is really the first step for what the group is hoping for and intending. I think it's a long road to get to where this group and other advocates are trying to aim for, having a facility, having a home, and being in there. But this is the very first step, and I think every journey starts with the first step. So we're taking it.
All right. And with Thank that, I renew my motion that House File 3048, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no. Motion prevails, and House File 3048 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Thank you.
Thank you.
As amended. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Tice. And as she makes her way down, Representative Tice moves that House File 3287 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. We have the bill before us, and I'm not aware of any amendments. Representative Tice, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, this is really an exciting time for baby boomers because I think we're finally recognizing that they deserve the best. And what I'm hoping that we can continue to do is look at some of the innovations in in-home monitoring strategies and decide which ones are best to promote so that we can keep folks in their homes longer. Because we find that when we keep folks in their homes longer, we as a state of Minnesota save money. And so in order to make some really good decisions, I thought it was appropriate to have a bill that says we look at what is available out there and what are we best able to get behind and say this is some technologies that we can do that will save Minnesota in the long run. What's our best return on investment? And to also look at what's easiest for some of our folks to do. So with that, I'm basically going to turn it over to Mr. Greg Owen from Wilder Research, and he can tell us some of the work that they will do to help us prepare to make some of these good decisions.
Mr. Owen, welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Schumacher, Vice Chair Tice. Thank you for representatives and visitors. My name is Greg Owen. I'm a consulting scientist at Wilder Research. I've been at Wilder since 1979. I've been involved in aging research for about 25 years, including the evaluation of Wilder's programs, various programs that serve aging adults. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. The topic, which has become increasingly important to Wilder, the Minnesota Board on Aging, the Department of Human Services, the Minnesota Department of Health and policymakers, and that is how best to care for the burgeoning aging population as they seek to remain at home in the face of infirmity and functional decline. In my role as a social scientist, working with these various aging programs, including programs outside of Wilder and programs in other nonprofits, we've been pursuing research strategies for improving home and community-based services throughout Minnesota. The initiative proposed in House File 3287 is a logical extension of the work that we've been doing during the past two decades. The bill seeks to assess the range of in-home technological solutions available to us, identify the most promising strategies, determine each strategy's capacity for improving safety and reducing healthcare costs. The overall goal is to identify the best and most appropriate electronic innovations that are both acceptable to consumers and effective in supporting older adults as they seek to stay in their own residences for as long as possible. I recently served as a POA for a gentleman who finally passed at age 100. I work with a number of older adults in my church community, and I've already talked with two who said, well, if that kind of technology was available, yeah, I think I would want to do it. So we know that there's some appetite out there, although we don't fully understand it. Technology has changed our lives, and I'll wager that everyone in this room has some technology in their pocket right now that they didn't have in their pocket 20 years ago. The same transformation has happened in the world of in-home technology, including electronic alert systems, telemedicine monitoring strategies, as well as both passive and active sensing reporting systems. In fact, we're now seeing important federally funded demonstration studies tasked with the job of integrating specific health information and sensing technologies in order to provide an early alert system for people who may be at risk of hospitalization because they're not able to adequately attend to their own health and physical needs. Again, this is something especially important to those living in smaller and more isolated communities, as well as those who have no family caregivers to support them. The proposed bill seeks to position Minnesota squarely at the front edge of this technology revolution with a survey of the current field, a review of current evidence regarding the use and acceptance of this technology, nationwide interviews with key experts who are today testing a wide range of strategies that hold great potential for strengthening our home and community-based service system through innovation. If developed wisely in a manner acceptable to those who would be using these technologies, this technology has the potential to increase safety, reduce costs associated with healthcare and home-based service delivery, and reduce unnecessary hospital or emergency room visits. In the short time since Chairman Schumacher's visit to Wilder, we have dug further into this topic and realized that this has become a sprawling area in its scope and depth, and that the early health alert systems that we are all now familiar with, the ones that folks wear around their necks, which oftentimes we find that older adults are reluctant to activate because they don't want people to be burdened by them. I've heard recent stories of that from two people. We've learned that researchers at the University of Maine have begun pursuing a similar quest in looking at this technological innovation as part of the annual Maine Geriatrics Conference, which is not surprising. Last year, they looked at their expansive geography and their far-flung rural areas, and they thought, we better look at this system, this set of systems, too. So there are some people that have begun this quest. The research we're proposing would take advantage of the best knowledge in the field from experts throughout the U.S. Using in-depth interviews as well as review of evidence-based literature and peer-reviewed literature, and to understand these technologies that are available. We've proposed to begin with a literature review, which would focus on the enumeration of the technologies, an analysis of the leading-edge demonstration studies, including both state and federally funded initiatives, and evidence from recent studies regarding effectiveness, uptake, utilization, and benefits. We already know that people 65 and older are becoming increasingly tech-savvy. This year will be my 65th birthday, so I'm well aware of the world that I have been dragged into. We know that the uptick in the numbers of people that are engaging in this technology is really quite amazing. 2012, just over half of those 65 and older were using the internet. Already by 2013, it was up to 60%. 77% in 2013 had a cell phone, compared to 69% in 2012. So that's a 10% increase over just a single year in the uses of these technologies. Almost half older adults, internet users, visit sites like Facebook and LinkedIn, and we find that they're one of the fastest growing user demographics in Facebook and LinkedIn and other type of media. Between 55 and 70% of residents in some assisted living facilities here in the Midwest have owned at least one computer, and over half use a computer several times a week. So this is not foreign territory. These changes mean we have also the potential for adopting other technology that can benefit us by increasing safety, improving medication compliance, sensing distress, connecting individuals with caregivers and other service providers who can benefit from early warnings of distress and related health. Wilder is prepared to begin this work immediately in cooperation with the Minnesota Board on Aging. I've been in contact with Carrie Benson, our new executive director of the board. She doesn't see any reason that this isn't a strategy that would help us to gain greater knowledge at this time. So I'll be happy to take questions, Chairman Schumacher.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Owen, for your work and for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Okay. I'll move to member questions. We'll start with Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Tice. You know, I know this is something that is we need to look at. I'm just a little confused about the bill itself. And if you could just explain what a research organization with expertise in community is, that would be great as a start.
Representative Tice.
Okay, I'm. Thank you, Mr.
Line
Chair.
1.8.
Okay. So I'm sorry. What was your question again?
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Tice. I just want a clearer understanding or definition of what that means.
Right, Representative Rosenthal. From my understanding, when we draft bills, we usually don't do the grants directly to any particular organization for that, and so we keep the language to allow for others to bid on it and go in that way. Does that get to where you're at, or is it more just the types of words that were used to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That goes towards more into it.
Okay.
And I would just suggest that maybe we can clean up the language somehow.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, to follow up on that point, I think the concern is, you know, we realize you can't name a specific organization, but the concern is because the reason for that is it is put out for a bid, that you need to put some kind of parameters on what the expectations are for the capabilities of that organization so that you're not forced to award the grant to someone else who isn't as capable of doing the research as what you had envisioned. And so there's a difference between keeping the language general and the language being vague. So it needs to have something more concrete to it so that we'll know what this organization looks like when we see it. Okay? And then, secondly, one of my concerns is, and we're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place on this. We really do need this information. My concern is that by the time we get the report, it's going to be obsolete. So this is just kind of we just sort of need a kick in the head on this issue. We've got to figure out a way that we can do this on an ongoing basis and continue to be informed about it so that we don't lag the technology by a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, because a lot of this technology is already in place and already being used. We heard some of it last year, you know, with the GPS bracelets and all of that. I mean, the stuff has moved so fast. My son's got a puppy with a GPS collar that tracks its activity. So he knows at work, you know, when the dog's asleep. Or, you know, and when the neighbor called to say the dog got out, he can find the dog, you know. So, We got to figure out a way, and that's not going to be addressed in the scope of your bill. This is really more directed at us as the committee moving forward. There's a lot of opportunity in this area, and we maybe need to look at how we can encourage Department of Human Services to get on top of this and have an ongoing information base on this. My final thing is just a question to the testifier. How do you envision the $40,000 would be spent if your organization was doing this?
Mr. Owen.
Thank you, Chairman, Representative. Based on studies that we've done in the past, Wilder is an organization that's embedded in the Wilder Foundation, which is a large private philanthropy most of you are familiar with. And because we are one of those operating foundations, we provide independent research to a wide number of organizations, including ongoing projects we have right now with the Minnesota Board on Aging and the Area Agencies on Aging. We would envision doing this project like we have done many other reviews of these types, in which we begin with a scan of the literature, understanding where the best evidence base is. Also, looking for particularly evidence related to acceptance and uptake of the technologies. That's one of the key issues in terms of honing in on particular strategy to get behind, whether we do it as a demonstration study or any other type of study. But in this case, we would look at that range of literature, identify the promising methodologies that were out there, and then conduct expert interviews with those around the state. We've already, and around the country, we've already identified maybe half a dozen, including a very important demonstration study in Missouri. These are federally funded studies, and so the idea would be to, as you say, get knowledge up to date for the time at which the study is produced. But I think you're absolutely right. At that time, you may be on top of your knowledge, but it's very easy for that knowledge to decay over a very short time afterwards. So it's important that the state would be able to follow along with some decisions around in what area to invest a particular strategy, whether to do it as a demonstration or a project through the Board on Aging.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I wasn't really clear with my question. I meant really the money is going toward personnel.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Sure. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's virtually all staffing. Yes, all staffing costs.
Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The committee may remember last year we had a presentation from a group in Mankato, VINE, the Volunteer Interfaith Network effort. Are you familiar with those?
Mr. Chairman, I'm familiar with the Interfaith Volunteer Network, but I don't know that particular testimony.
Representative Considine.
Thank you. They've been doing what you're talking about doing and have been very successful with keeping seniors in their homes for extended period of time through a comprehensive effort of volunteers, technology. I would suggest that might be a good place to start. It's in Mankato, and they do great work.
Thank you, Representative Considine. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the testifiers. Again, going back to research organizations, so would, say, for instance, the University of Minnesota, some of the other senior organizations throughout the state be able to qualify for that? That's all. Just want a little bit more clarification to either one.
Mr. Owen?
Mr. Chairman, I could offer some comments. I've contacted some of my colleagues at the University of Minnesota, Joe Gogler in particular, who helped develop the rapid screen that's widely used in Minnesota today. He has identified a few potential leads on this and is prepared to cooperate in this project. This is kind of one of those, it's better to do it as a village. We would draw in some of our best collaborators and colleagues from around the state, including institutions like the university. If your question is, would the University of Minnesota qualify as a potential vendor of the service, I believe they would.
Okay.
Representative Mason.
Thank you.
Okay, that's all I had on the list. Were there others? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Tice. I'm just not sure about some of these bills this morning, like the next one coming up and this one. It just seems like some of this is, I'm not going to say not needed, but some of the trends with seniors it's fairly obvious, kind of, you know, especially the next one, kind of where we're, what we need to do and where some of the cost drivers are, and, you know, that one's a little different with some of the end of life issues are probably more of a, you know, harder thing to discuss. Well, anyways, on yours, my question is, it just strikes me as a little odd, and I've always been a big supporter of Wilder and the work that they do, but, you know, I'm familiar with the organization, and I don't know why they don't, you know, given their foundation, it just seems like something that with their senior focus that I guess my challenge is to you, I don't know why they wouldn't just fund it themselves. You know, 40 grand out of a multi-million dollar foundation just really seems like a drop in a bucket, and you know, and I, when your focus is seniors and some of these issues, you know, I kind of went through using technology. I just went through kind of your foundation, and you better be careful. You said you're about 65. I think Mr. Amberst died at 66. So make sure I think he died of a kidney infection or
yes,
something.
He did.
So. I didn't know that could kill you, but apparently it can. That was 1800s.
Yes.
So, but anyways, I would like to turn it back to you and why, given your focus as a foundation, instead of us kind of narrowing language and sending this out to bid,
sure.
why don't, I mean, it just seems like it'd be right down in your sweet spot as far as like foundation work and effort. Why you wouldn't fund this yourselves?
to your own mortality, Mr. Owen.
Thank you, Representative.
Sorry about that.
Chairman Schumacher. Yes.
The numbers were too close.
I become more aware of my own mortality every day.
Wow.
One of the things that probably is not widely known is that the Wilder Foundation only provides a modest subsidy to the research department. We have, right now, we have 12 different aging research agendas. That is 12 different aging projects going on. We have at least three with the Minnesota Board on Aging and one with the area agencies, and then we have evaluations of Wilder-owned programs. Wilder pays Wilder Research. The foundation pays Wilder Research to evaluate Wilder's aging services programs. We do not currently offer any kind of technological strategy for in-home monitoring. And the initiative for this bill came from the legislature, from folks here in this room, not from Wilder. And so as we do in virtually all projects, we estimate what the actual cost of doing the project would be, and then we provide an estimate or a bid on the work as we see it. We are certainly interested in contributing to this, and we do provide in-kind support for a variety of projects. Our statewide homeless research, which we just finished, showing a 9% drop in homelessness but an increase in older adult homelessness, that study was heavily subsidized by Wilder in order to bring that forward. But Wilder cannot subsidize all of the research that people are interested in doing, and so we do have a large, you know, cadre of customers that seek our work.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your comments. I realize it's, and you do great work, and I know there's a lot of need. It just seemed like it was right in the sweet spot for what you're working on, and relative 40,000 didn't seem like that much, you know, given the size of the foundation. But thank you for the work the foundation does. Representative Tice, I just kind of want to know what your plan is then with this information. How are we going to use this? What, you know, how, so when it's done, what's your plan? How are we going to see this? How's it going to help the aging in Minnesota?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly. I'm glad you asked, because actually, I love technology. I worked in the computer industry for several years, and you're right. The minute we would put a new machine together, it was obsolete, and you just never get ahead of it. But what I would like to see is if to go further, and if we want to help, if we want to help older adults get away, probably with some type of grant or whatever it is, to get some of these technologies in their home, I just think Minnesota wins financially. If we can help folks get this technology in their home to stay home longer, then that's a good win for us. So what I'm hoping is that when we get data back and they say, these are some of the things that we think are a really good bet, that you get your best return on investment, you know, it's easy for them to use, they will use it, they won't just get it and then have it, but they'll engage with it. I think when we know, we kind of have a sure bet going in which products work really well, then when we step forward and say, hey, I want to get some funding for this so that we can have folks do this to keep them in their homes, I think we're ahead of the game. And that's pretty much how I run. If I want to do something, I'll do the research behind it, find out what my best bet is, what avenue I should go, and then go from there. So, and I apologize for I'm just kind of like focused on one thing, and mm-hmm. perhaps I didn't get what you were going on it, but I really enjoy that. So to get research from Wilder, who does a lot of research in what I'm interested in, makes sense to me, because then I know which products to say, okay, let's go. Let's run with this. And we know that it's a better bet to get it through, that if we want to fund a particular thing or use a particular system, we've got the research to back us up to say we're not just pulling straws out of a hat, or that's a really bad analogy. I screwed something up there. But we're just not just picking stuff out of the air. We've got the research behind us to say this is a good product. This is good for everybody. It's a win-win for everyone. And I feel a lot more confident going that route than just saying, oh, it kind of sounds good, let's just try this. I want to know that when I put something forward, it's almost a win-win before we start.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Tice. I appreciate what you're saying, and I'm glad not to diminish the work of Wilder too, but I hope we consider putting this forward to like the University of Minnesota and having, you know, maybe their health students researching this as well, or, you know, just, you know, on a bigger scale as well. But so, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm, you think our plan then is for the aging of Minnesota then is to have all a bunch of mini houses and in driveways and high tech? Is that there kind of where we're going here, it seems like, this year? I'm just teasing you. But I better start building my mini house.
Build it fast, Representative.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Tice, I like the idea that, you know, we should be studying this, and I think you're onto something here, whether it's the mini houses, the technology, whatever, because if the people on this committee, if the members on this committee realize what will happen in the out years with the nursing home funding reform, now that nursing homes are funded on a cost basis, the projection in the out years is enormous. I mean, this is a cost that's just going to go whoosh. And so we in Minnesota have much more incentive than we ever did to keep people out of the nursing homes and in their homes, right? Or somewhere besides the nursing home anyway, because it's going to be so expensive for us in Minnesota. I'm afraid that it's going to break the bank, seriously. And so, you know, whoever does this, I don't know, Representative Lilly might be right that, you know, maybe this is too small. Maybe we need to think, I mean, I'm not opposed to this at all. I'm really glad you brought it up. But maybe we need to incorporate this kind of, if the idea is that eventually we'll help pay for it in some way, we need to really be on top of it, and we need to incorporate it into our ongoing analysis of what's going on and find a way to, you know, keep up with the technology a little bit in terms of what we'll fund, and, you know, and have some start to get our hands around what's effective and what's just whiz-bang stuff. And we all know, you know, we see that with technology all the time. You know, the greatest new thing may turn out to be a dud for some reason. So we really need to be working on this. I think it's really great, but I hope that this is just a little kickoff to something that's much larger and more permanent that will continue, because I think this is definitely the direction we need to go.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Are there any other questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Tice, any final comments?
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. I'm ready to go bigger because I love technology, and I absolutely agree with Mr. Owens when he says that when you look at the data, seniors are some of the growing folks using technology. And I will say that when I worked in the computer industry in the middle 90s, that always surprised us when we had somebody come in that was, actually I had a woman that would come in her 80s, and she knew exactly how the computer worked and what parts it were and everything, and we would just giggle because it was just so much fun to have those conversations. And they are interested in technology, and I know my kids complain that they wish my dad would stay off of Facebook. So, you know, it's a nice way for folks, and I know why they do it, because my dad then knows where his family is and what they're doing. And so I don't see that ending anytime soon. I really think the trend is going to go up. And so I think if we're going to keep up with keeping people home, we really got to look at this. So I'm willing to go bigger and broaden it out. I really don't care who does the research as long as they're a wonderful, credible source. I just want to see some data, and I think it's very timely in that we will have some information back by the time we start session next year. So I think it's a good place to start, and that's basically what I want. I want to get the conversation started. I want to get a starting place someplace. And I think, too, when you hear, too, about hospice, people just do better in a home setting. And I think we hear that over and over again, and that truly is the motivation behind this, is trying to keep folks at home because our nursing homes are full and they can't staff, and we just got to look at, it's just going to get worse. And so we got to look at ways to keep them at home, and I think this is a great start. So thank you very much, and I hope you support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Tice. With that, Representative Tice renews her motion that House File 3287 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion prevails, and House File 3287 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Thank you, Representative Tice.
Thank you.
Now, members, we have a very special treat. Representative Anderson is here with his first bill in the legislature. And as he makes his way to the front, Representative Anderson moves that House File 3350 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. We have the bill before us, and I'm not aware of any amendments. Representative Anderson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. There are some cookies here that we'll pass around.
Nice start, Representative.
There you go. This morning, I am proud to present House File 3350, which is a bill that will create a Minnesota-specific simulation model to predict the needs and future utilization of long-term care services and support for Minnesota based on demographic and economic factors. It will also estimate the cost of care under a variety of funding scenarios in order to determine the impact of financing options. Minnesota is looking at 60,000 new seniors per year through the year 2030. A survey conducted by DHS in 2010 found that 32% of Minnesotans don't know how they will pay for long-term care, while another 18% expect a government program to pay for their long-term care. In addition to the dramatic growth of seniors, Minnesotans are living longer, thanks to my cookies, and have a higher and have higher care needs, all of which lead to an increase in the amount of long-term care expenses. We need to start looking into what these options are, as we had talked about earlier, and as individuals and as a state, and how we're going to pay for these expenses. I am pleased to be able to bring forward this bill to help address the financing of long-term care in Minnesota. A simulation model specific to Minnesota will provide a powerful tool for use by policymakers to help them estimate and compare costs of financing long-term care of the elderly in the future under several possible financing scenarios. Using a simulation model can help identify those options that maximize the amount of private financing dollars from insurance and other financial products and minimize the use of Medicaid dollars within the state budget. Today I have two testifiers for the long-term care imperative who will walk us through the bill and address any questions that you guys may have.
All right, welcome to the committee. I don't know if you've been here before, so if you could please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Erin Bowie. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Care Providers of Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Anderson for bringing this bill forward. As we all know, Minnesota is aging. People here are living longer. The cost of care is going up, and people are not saving for their long-term care needs. The current long-term care financing products available are not seeing widespread use, and we feel this bill is a good first step in identifying long-term care financing options that are viable and sustainable for individuals and families in Minnesota.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Carrie Thurlow, Senior Vice President of Advocacy at Leading Age Minnesota. I, too, want to thank Representative Anderson for bringing forward House File 3350. This is actually foundational to the conversation that we need to have here in Minnesota. Excuse me. According to national data, about half of Americans over the age of 65 will need some sort of long-term care services and supports. That's the non-medical care for assistance with activities of daily living. Primarily, this is due to either chronic disease or disability. And of course, as Minnesotans age, for every year over the age of 65, that need for long-term care services and supports increase. As Ms. Bowie pointed out, relatively few Minnesotans, and indeed nationally, take up long-term care insurance. It's at best 10%, although between 2005 and 2012, national rates of selling long-term care insurance policies have actually reduced. Also, as Representative Anderson pointed out, relatively few of individuals in this age group have sufficient savings to cover their needs. So while they start out, and about half of all long-term care services and supports are paid for out of pocket, many individuals quickly spend down and require Medicaid to support their financing their needs, usually when their needs are accelerating as well. And as many in the committee have pointed out today and otherwise, this means that we'll have strain on our state budgets, as well as on our own family budgets, our own personal budgets, both for the older adult and for their direct family, and it creates emotional strain well. So we need to have the conversation about what we can do to change our policies to address this growing need. There have been several attempts at the federal level to try to address this. As early as the 1990s, there was the Pepper Commission that introduced and proposed a social insurance model to address some of these needs. Unsuccessfully, that passed. As recently as 2010, the CLASS Act passed, although was never implemented due to actually insufficient information, which is what this bill would do to try to ground our discussion and our policy solutions in actual actuarial data. The CLASS Act was actually repealed in 2013. Here at the state level, we've had lots of discussions and have made various attempts on a bipartisan basis over time to introduce new strategies. And a few years ago, we established the Own Your Future initiative, which is a broad stakeholder group that was initially led by the Lieutenant Governor, Pretner Solon, and then later on by the Department of Human Services. It includes representatives from the long-term care insurance industry, the Imperative, consumer groups, and others, where they just last year introduced a report with several recommendations. This study was actually one of those recommendations, recognizing that we need the data and the grounding to actually evaluate the various policy options that we have to address this growing need. And while there have been models at the state, at the federal level, introduced late last year and several recommendations, we know that Minnesota has a tradition of making up our own solutions to suit Minnesotans, which means that we need a model to also suit Minnesota needs, which is what this proposal does. So we are very glad that Representative Anderson is bringing this forward. We think that it will be important information as we come back next session to look at options to address these needs.
All right, thank you. Members, in your packets, you have a letter from Assistant Commissioner Coleman regarding the bill. It's my understanding that he was unable to be here in person today because he is out of town. I was wondering if anyone from the department would wish to speak to this bill for just a moment, and it looks like they do. Ms. Tweet, welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and provide us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Stacey Tweet with the Department of Human Services. I guess I won't add too much to what's in Assistant Commissioner Coleman's letter, but as members of the Imperative have said, we've been actively engaged in this conversation for many years through our Own Your Future initiative. We've been continuing to work on this both locally and nationally. Assistant Commissioner Coleman and our lead staffer on the Own Your Future initiative are actually in D.C. presenting at this on this very topic at a national conference. So it's something we're continuing to work on and appreciate Representative Anderson's work to bring this forward.
All right, thank you. Questions for the testify, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I'm looking at the bill, it's $200,000 in fiscal 2017, and then it's $200,000 more in fiscal 2018. So the bill is asking for $400,000. And so my question is, you know, what is involved in this? I don't have a good sense of, I mean, obviously the goal is important, but what are we really doing here? Is this a computer simulation model that we'll be able to then plug different scenarios into it as we think about ways we might want to approach this, and then it... So what's the $400,000 going to buy us?
Ms. Dwight.
Representative Liebling and Mr. Chair, we have a national model, as I think the previous testifiers mentioned, that has this kind of data at a national level. And so it is building the computer, the data system. There is this database of people of a certain age, of a certain demographic. It's taking that data and then bringing it to a specific level. So it is running the analytics, doing the research, doing the math, if you will, on plugging in various policy options. So what if we were to do certain things in Medicaid? What would that cost a consumer? What would it cost the state? So it is paying for that analytical time. We would put this out via contract. We think there perhaps is some in-state entity that could do this, probably the university. It could be a national bidder, but we would put that out for bid. to see who could do that work.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm still kind of unclear about it. So we don't have to actually build the computer model. That's something that's kind of there that we can adapt. And so running the data, paying for analytical time, just seems like a whole lot of money for that. You know, the last bill we did was a tenth of this for a little study. It's kind of okay, you know, $40,000. That's real money to an awful lot of people, but here in the legislature, not really. But $400,000, you're getting to real money even here in the legislature. So I just, maybe the author could speak to that a little bit. I'm sure you've looked at, you know, where the money would actually go, and, you know, how are we talking about hiring some number of people? Are we talking about, well, you said we're contracting. I don't know who the potential contractors would be. And I guess my real question is, where did this number come from?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yeah, I'm excited about this. We had talked about this in the last bill, that it wasn't, we thought that last amount maybe wasn't enough, and we talked about how important this was and to go more in depth. And as I was sitting listening, I got more excited about the bill, just getting more information. And so that's what this one is about, is getting that more information that we had talked about.
Ms. Dwight.
If I might add to that, Representative Liebling and Chair Schumacher, I think we had asked the university in particular what cost they thought they would need to do this, and this was our best estimate. We could certainly go back and talk with them, but we did ask others what is an appropriate cost to put on this, and that's the estimate we got back. But certainly when we would bid something, we'd have to take that into account as well. But I'm happy to get you more information about that. I just don't have it right in front of me.
Yeah, Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So, Representative Anderson, I think it's really different, though, than what I was suggesting on the last one, was that we, you know, it's good to study it once, but that we need to have a process, probably in government, in DHS, so that the use of the technologies becomes kind of part of our ongoing consideration as we're figuring out how to fund. And maybe that would go into something like this, too. And I'm not against the concept at all. You know, I just want to make sure that, you know, that taxpayer dollars are being well spent here for something that's actually going to be helpful, because it's almost $500,000, and it's not entirely clear to me if this would be something at the end of the day, after the $400,000 are spent and we get the report back, you know, what is the report going to tell us? Because, you know, I know you're new, but those of us who've been here for a while, we've got stacks of reports. We can barely find the time to read them. And granted, some are more important than others, but, you know, if we're going to spend the money, I want to make sure that it comes back as something that we really can use, because we desperately need to figure all this stuff out. You know, I don't see this. I'm not sure if this is an ongoing thing. That's kind of where my questions are going about. Is it technology that we'll then have available to us forever, that we can plug in new data and say, okay, now we go this way, now we go that way? Or is it going to be sort of a one-time, you know, here are your options, or what do we get at the end?
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And just to the point, I think I can answer one of your questions, hopefully, for you, and so I thought I'd just bring it up. There is no report with it. It's actually to build the model with this. So the reports that often or sometimes go unnoticed around here, we don't have that with this one. It is a model that we're working with. Ms. Dwight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. I think we're the appropriation is time limited, so we absolutely didn't want to have this as ongoing funding, but we have done some looking at what are the various options that could work, should work in Minnesota. Some of the things we've talked about is an insurance product that starts out as a life insurance product and converts to long-term care insurance, various ideas with Medicare. The national model that we've been referencing tested three specific ideas, and I have that report with me if you'd be interested in it, but was kind of focused on those three things. We still want to take some time through our Own Your Future work, through many of you who've been interested in this topic, to say what are those couple of things that we want to to test with this. What are those good ideas for Minnesota? Build those into the model and come back and talk to you again about it. So I don't think we're seeing it as an ongoing process. We're trying to start this conversation about it. Let's have some real data behind what the solutions are and give that to policymakers to come up with different ideas on how to pay for this growing problem.
And Representative Lieben, I do have to apologize. There is a report that goes with it. I'm sorry for that. But the modeling, there is also modeling that goes on. It's not just the report.
Okay.
Representative Lieben.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to point that out. There is a report here. But also then, it sounds to me like you have some ideas about maybe where we should go that you want to model now. Is that accurate?
Ms. Dwight.
I believe that's correct, but we have this report that Ms. Thurlow mentioned that was out last year. We've been talking to many people about what are the top things that make sense. I don't know that there's consensus. There's a lot of ideas, many of which this committee heard last session, some about using your retirement funds, using your long-term care insurance differently. We've talked about a bunch of different ideas, so I think we need to come to consensus about what to put in the model and go from there.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, just sorry, the last little thing then. But then, if that being the case, is there an opportunity for members to suggest things that they'd like to see modeled?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, we would absolutely be open to any and all ideas. We absolutely see this as a collaborative process and are very interested in your ideas on how to go from there. And I know Commissioner Coleman actually has a meeting with you tomorrow, I believe, so I'm happy to get more information from you at that time.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, what is wrong with the national model that has already been established that would preclude us from using that right now to determine, you know, what we should be doing? Or have you looked at other states to see what other states are doing?
Representative Anderson or Ms. Thurlow?
You want me to? Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative, the brief answer is the authors of the federal model that we're talking about, that was the results of which were published in a Health Affairs article in November of 2015. The authors of that model would even recognize that it's first generation and that there needs to be more work done. It is the first attempt anywhere to do a modeling of various proposals. No other state has done this. At the federal level, they are even looking at, of course, they need to look for financing as well to keep the work ongoing. But the authors would say it's a preliminary set. There are still several questions that need to be answered that the model raises. And I think they would acknowledge that if states want to pursue actions on their own, that we should be sure that we're modeling not just national data, but state-specific data. I think Commissioner Coleman's letter points out some unique characteristics that Minnesota has, our age span, the number of women in the workforce and others, the availability of informal caregivers that probably make also justify a state-specific model as well.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to mention that Senator Eakin and I have been looking at this, and one of our calculations is that if you raise the salaries of people who provide home health care or nursing home care to $15 an hour, we're talking about a $4 billion increase, $4 billion, which is 10% of the existing budget. So I would guess my question to Representative Anderson is, would you propose raising taxes or some other way to pay for that?
Representative Anderson.
We can have a conversation about whatever needs to be done. I'm just excited about this bill. We need to get things figured out and get information that we can talk about and have intelligent conversations about with this information that we'll get.
Representative Newton.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, being excited is great, but we're going to have to pay for this, and it is an ongoing cost, and we're only going to have more and more people who will be needing the care. So I think rather than spending a lot of time on studies, we should be looking at how we're going to be paying for what we already know, and we're not doing a very good job of that right now. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newton. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to do a little venting here. We've now, and this basically, I think, is going towards the the baby boomers, which we've known for over 60 years, they were going to grow old. So we've had a lot of time to study this. And I remember participating in a study. It was a joint study between, like, the university, Department of Health, et cetera. And it was done during Governor Pawlenty's time, and I'm thinking earlier in his, during his tenure. And it was on specifically on long-term care. And the outcome of that big vote was the fact that the state could not pay for everybody. We were supposed to be encouraging people to do something about long-term care products. I don't know if that ever happened. And what I'm seeing here is, you know, it seems to be it's more than just doing an update. It's still talking about how to solve a problem that we've known about for decades and decades. And so how do we, I guess maybe kind of going where Representative Newton is, when do we start doing the action to solve the problem rather than just on studying and studying and studying? We know there's a problem. We know the state can't afford it. I mean, that's the bottom line, unless we come up with money. So I guess where, if you can tell me where what you're putting forward is different than anything else that has been done in the past, because I just, as I said, the time is, we're way past where we should have been as far as planning and goals.
Thank you for your rant, Representative. Ms. Thurlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mason. You're right. We need to do something. I think the difference that this model brings to the discussion is that I think we have been bringing, that there have been discussions about policy options before without necessarily a common base of understanding of how that influences state budget and individual behavior. And what you have seen in the past are policy proposals that have been brought forward both at the state and the federal level that quite honestly don't get passed because the stakeholders are not speaking the same language and operating from the same base of knowledge. And so nothing actually gets passed. And I think that what we have seen with the initial model at the federal level and what we hope to do with a more sophisticated state model is to have that base of knowledge so that everybody is testing those policy proposals with a common base, and then we can have the conversation from there. We know that long-term care insurance is not a solution for everyone. Not many people are taking them up, despite the fact that Minnesota is actually doing pretty better than the nation as an average. We know we can't rely on that, and we know that Medicaid as the default payer is not really a solution either. We can all agree on that. But then how to solve it and what the assumptions are, how that will influence the state policy, is not clear, and that's why we need the model.
Any follow-up, Representative Mason?
None that'll resolve the problem right away. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a little excited when I saw the micro-simulation term, but then it wasn't what I was hoping it was. You know, we have a fundamental disconnect between the fact that people have an expectation that they will be taken care of, and their expectations of how we're going to pay for that. The fallback position is that, well, the government will take care of me. And in other countries, that's a viable fallback position because the society has decided collectively that, so then we'd better pay for it. And we've gotten ourselves into a political situation where we're just letting the wool be pulled over our eyes year after year after year after decade after decade after decade. And we've decided we're unwilling to pay for that. That's not my decision. I would be willing to pay for that. But we aren't giving people the tools they need to have an alternative to that in terms of their own planning. And so I would like to see more effort being put into providing accessible tools for families to plan ahead. Now, when somebody's in the hospital and they got to go somewhere, we've got a system for that. You know, they meet with the social worker, and there's the Senior Connect line and all of that. But at that point, you're already in a crisis situation, and you no longer have the ability to adjust anything about your life to make that accommodation. And pretty much you're looking for, where am I going to put somebody? So we need to get better at providing information for families ahead of that point. So families that are doing their financial planning and long in advance, you know, like me, families that have a person who's beginning to show signs of a disability that may end up needing more advanced care, what can they do now that's going to maintain their options? And what are those real options? Because when my folks got to the point where my mom couldn't take care of my dad, he had ataxia, you know, there were things they could have done in advance of that to make their home accessible. What does that cost? You know, we heard, you know, that to make a home completely ADA accessible costs a certain amount of money, but what are your, you know, options below that point that can enable somebody to stay in their home and enable somebody else to take care of them? What are our options for in-home care? People don't know. You know, they frankly, I mean, my mother at that point, it was just beyond her capability to find out what her options might have been to do that. So this is why I got excited about the micro part, because I was actually thinking micro. Okay, this is somewhere, what you're talking about is, you know, to my mind, kind of somewhere between, we don't really have a good Greek prefix for somewhere between macro and micro. So I would like, you know, like to find a way to fit that into this project, that there is a tool developed for families now that, you know, the way we could do that is by accessing some kind of thing on the internet that would give us this information. I'd like to see a side-by-side cost of, you know, what is, you know, nursing home care costs this and provides that, assisted living costs this, 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 and this, and provides this, is because they're not all the same. It's one of the things we found out, you know, and in-home care and all of that. Because, you know, I looked the other day when we were having this conversation. I looked. And, you know, my county doesn't have that. They can tell me what their services are, but they can't tell me what is my other range, you know, what's my range of possibilities. That it's not a rant. It's just, it's a prod. Thank you.
Thank you for the prod, Representative Yarusso. Members, we do have about 8 minutes left, and we do have one more bill coming forward, and a couple people left on the list. Ms. White.
If I may, Chair, and just to respond really quickly, Representative Yarusso, we'd be absolutely open to talking with you about that. It's one of the recommendations in this report that Ms. Thurlow mentioned earlier, is that we needed a commonplace, an easy tool, a resource for people to really work through this with their families. It's a hard conversation to have with your family about what have you thought about mom, dad, aunt, uncle, for how we're going to pay for this and who is going to take care of you when you can no longer take care of yourself. So we absolutely be open to having more conversations with you about that, and can point you to some of the work we've done thus far on that topic.
Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really had not planned on speaking, but as I'm listening to this conversation, there's actually a model out there right now that works for every other country that is economically as developed as we are. It's called the single-payer health plan. It works for all the European countries. Canada, 70-80% of the people are very happy with their system, and it works. So we can keep planning, and we can keep talking, and we can keep coming back, or we can look at a solution that has worked for a large number of countries around the world. Thank you.
Thank you for being moved to mention that. Representative Considine. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson.
The final questions today come from Representative Lilly, by the way.
How you doing today? So I'm just kind of wondering, you're a newer representative here, right? So. So what was your answer? I didn't really hear the answer on the $400,000. Do you think we should raise the tax on the Mall America to pay for that, the $400,000?
Representative Lilly, I don't think that was the question that was asked by Representative Newton.
It's close.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lilly. Did you get the cookie that I had sent over there? I have more, too, if that would help.
I didn't get the pass at hockey either.
Okay, sorry about that. We're talking about the simulation model here. Just trying to figure out what is best
for our population, Minnesota specific, and I think that's what we need to get an answer here for. There's a lot of ideas, and we need to get consensus of what those good ideas will be and move forward from there.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson. No, I think it's you know, it's basically I think it's a good, you know, bill. I think the effort, I mean, it's sad to me too, as some of the people have expressed it up here, and I'm sure your side would say this same. I mean, we've known this senior tsunami is coming. It's not a big secret. It's expensive. Americans don't have any money saved up. There's so much in this letter. There's a lot of studies already going on, you know, around the country, and reports, and, you know, so I agree with, you know, some of the reports we keep getting back, and we're not always using all of them, but, and I'm certain that we will use this report, but you know, it's just sad to me that Americans, you know, they've not been able to save. I just know how it is. I mean, there was a study that recently came out that most people in the U.S., if they had a bill that showed up unexpectedly for $1,000, just $1,000, would not be able to pay it. So when you look at these numbers, the average cost for long-term care is $57,000. And, you know, so that's pretty clear that people aren't going to be able to afford that when the annual income is 59 or that they don't even have 1,000. So, I mean, it's just an ongoing thing. And then I also wish that we'd study other things like quality of life and fitness and food and other things too. But we're not talking about that today. We're talking about money and people. Right. But thank you for the cookies. Anyways, that's it.
All right. Final comment, Representative Anderson.
Thank you for the opportunity, or thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thanks for the opportunity to present this bill.
That is a great closing. And with that, Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 3350 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no. Motion prevails, and House File 3350 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Given the time, I'm going to just do the bill from the chair here, so if my testifiers would make their way on down. I'm going to move that House File 3039 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. I'm not aware of any amendments. The bill before us here is a nursing facility exception bill, moratorium exception bill. Because Minnesota has a moratorium on bed and new construction projects for nursing facilities, looking at projects that will cost more than $1.565 million, an exception process has been established in Minnesota that provides for the Commissioner of Health to allow for new building processes and for facilities that face extreme hardship and are replacing or are replacing the facility. This bill provides additional funding to cover the MA rates for the facilities on the property side that receive the exception. It is projected that these funds will have a direct state impact of over 1,800 new jobs, $232 million in total economic activity, $74 million in wages, and $6.7 million in indirect business taxes. Here with me today are Jeff Bostick and Todd Bergstrom from the Long-Term Care Imperative, who will be happy to take any questions. Please give us your testimony.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm Jeff Bostick with Leading Age Minnesota, part of the Long-Term Care Imperative, here to speak very briefly in support of House File 3039. As you know, last year we made some significant investments in the operations of nursing homes, but the property payment system continues to remain the same, and we need to continue to make investments in modernizing nursing homes throughout the state. And this fund that this bill would replenish is the primary way that's accomplished. As Representative Schellmacher mentioned, there is a threshold below which you can make an investment in your facility and receive a property rate. For investments that exceed the threshold of a little more than $1.5 million, approval is required. There's a process where you apply for funding, and these are the projects that really make a big difference in the lives of seniors, creating modernized facilities, in some cases entirely new facilities, replacing older buildings, which in many cases is what is out there in the state. And the $1 million that would be authorized by this bill actually does more than you might think to look at it. $1 million doesn't sound like a lot for construction. But Todd, with care providers, going to talk a little bit more about how the process actually works and how much construction can actually be covered for that level of state funding.
Mr. Bergstrom, briefly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Bergstrom with Care Providers Minnesota, and along with Jeff from Leading Age, are representing the Long-Term Care Imperative. Yes, as Jeff alluded to, so in the last major round of the moratorium, 14 nursing facilities throughout the state were approved for projects that totaled around $140 million. And so the reason why that works is what we're asking for under this appropriation is to cover the state Medicaid share of the interest and equity incentive under the property system. And as Representative Schumacher alluded to, that activity drives a lot of economic activity, including the most recent estimate of 1,800 new jobs, $232 million in economic activity, as well as wages and indirect business taxes. Finally, you'll note that under the bill last year, we did begin a study for a new system, and we view this as a bridge to getting to that new system.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, are there any questions from members? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3039 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion prevails and House File 3039 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. The meeting is adjourned.